Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, thousands of teachers across Kentucky and Oklahoma have entered the second day of their strikes for better pay, benefits, and working conditions in a movement that has spread rapidly since West Virginia teachers successfully struck earlier this year. Next, a report published over the weekend by sports news website Deadspin showed dozens of television news anchors from local stations around the country owned by the conservative Sinclair Broadcasting Group reciting the exact same script warning against what they called biased and false news. The episode reveals the power of a company long criticized for pushing its conservative agenda into homes across the country. Then, Russian President Vladimir Putin arrived in Ankara today to launch Turkey's first nuclear power plant with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, also in town to discuss Syria energy and defense issues. The Russian State Nuclear Energy Agency will build the $20 billion nuclear power facility. Meanwhile, the Russian state news agency noted that Russia will expedite the delivery of a Russian S-400 air defense system to Turkey. And then prosecutors in the Russia probe revealed last night that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein authorized them in August of last year to investigate allegations that President Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was colluding with Russian government officials to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. The revelation comes amid a lawsuit filed by Manafort, which challenges the special counsel's investigative authority and the indictments that have already been issued. And finally, yesterday, China announced an additional $3 billion in tariffs on U.S. goods, and the stock market took a huge hit. The big spike in stock market volatility indicates that a full-fledged trade war between the U.S. and China may be getting underway. The U.S. is now expected to announce further tariffs on $50 to $60 billion in Chinese imports, which the Chinese have already promised a response to in the same proportion. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to teacher strikes and protests across the country. Thousands of teachers across Kentucky and Oklahoma have entered the second day of their strikes for better pay, benefits, and working conditions in a movement that has spread rapidly since West Virginia teachers successfully struck earlier this year. We're joined from Greencastle, Indiana, by Derek Ford. He's an assistant professor of education studies at DePauw University and a community organizer whose latest book is Education and the Production of Space. Derek, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Derek, this really does seem to be a movement. We talked about it on our show yesterday, and one of the things that Brian mentioned that is true and I think is quite notable is that these strikes, for the most part, or even discussions of a strike, because Arizona, we haven't even begun to discuss Arizona and Kansas yet, but they're mostly happening in states that consider themselves to be so-called right-to-work states, or states that have successfully blocked teachers' unions from entering. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's definitely incredibly significant that in basically every single case, the movement has really been led by grassroots organizations that have been, independent of unions. In particular, Arizona, the organization that started there, Arizona Educators or Education United, has taken the lead, and the union, the sort of the statewide education affiliation, has said, we're going to support this protest movement and you take the reins. So what we're seeing, is also significant in terms of the labor movement and a real sort of return to the roots where it's really, the workers themselves who are setting the agenda rather than, the union leaders.
I'm looking at a chart here that shows the comparative salaries of high school teachers in the United States as compared to most of the countries of Western Europe. And we are at the bottom. The only European country that pays its teachers less than the United States is the Czech Republic. We pay our teachers roughly half of what teachers make in France and New Zealand and even Germany. Why is it that we just do not have a commitment in this country to paying our teachers? Why do Americans in general not understand that you get what you pay for in public education?
Yeah, I mean, you know, education in the United States has always been occupied a sort of contradictory position, and it's really always been a site of struggle. You know, we didn't have mass high schools in the United States until the 1920s and the 1930s. There was, and the only reason why there was access eventually, mass access, was because of, movements by the poor and working classes, movements that continued, struggles by Black people, other oppressed nations within the United States. However, really with, what's called the neoliberal turn, which began in middle of the 1970s, we've seen a systematic attack on public education and a systematic rollback of all the gains that were won through the previous eras of struggle. And really, that's been a bipartisan attack. It's something that, has, each presidency from Reagan, through Obama and now to Trump has, uniformly accepted that, public education should basically be, if not eradicated, then severely, severely reduced.
Last week, the governor of Oklahoma signed a bill that would give teachers, on average, a $6,100 pay raise. I would note that that would lift the average pay of Oklahoma teachers from the 49th worst in America to the 31st worst in America. So it doesn't really help that much. But more importantly, the teachers union in Oklahoma says, and here's a quote, "This package doesn't overcome shortfalls caused by 4-day weeks, overcrowded classrooms that deprive kids of the one-on-one attention that they need." We all know teachers who go out of pocket sometimes thousands of dollars just for basic supplies for their classrooms. But this teachers union statement is correct. It doesn't address the issues of overcrowding and 4-day classroom weeks.
You know, the other thing I think is important to point out, because we are witnessing the beginning of a movement. It's already begun.
It has.
These are in right-to-work states where it's illegal to have what's called a closed shop, where everyone has to either pay union dues or agency fees, even though they're represented as part of the collective bargaining unit. Why that's important for people who might not know is that if a union has to spend most of its time going around convincing people who are covered by the collective bargaining agreement for pay, for benefits, to convince them to pay just basic dues rather than to organize or grieve against complaints and problems that teachers are facing, or to fight in contract negotiations, or to prepare for a strike. If you have to spend all of your time just collecting dues because you can't have dues check off, then the union's weaker. And as a consequence, even though these right-wing states say this gives workers the right to work or not work in a union setting, what it basically has done is to diminish or weaken the unions. It's that simple, right?
Absolutely.
Now, what's interesting is, and this is where I was beginning, is that today is April 3rd. 50 years ago today, Martin Luther King Jr. was giving a speech at a mass rally for sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, also a right-to-work state. And it just becomes emblematic, Derek, in a way that sometimes the movements that overcome periods of political or social or anti-labor reaction start not in New York City, not in Berkeley, not in Chicago, not in Washington, D.C., but in places like Tennessee or West Virginia or Kentucky or Oklahoma, the so-called red states, the more conservative areas. But yet, because conditions are so hard and the people are doing it, the demonstrations of courage and unity so obvious, it's had this magnet effect in American history of becoming the starting points for larger movements. Do you think that we're on the verge of something larger?
I think absolutely. You know, schools are a flashpoint of unity in many ways. If you think about how many people are involved in the school system on a day-to-day basis, right? I mean, not just students and teachers, but administrators, janitors, counselors, therapists, bus drivers, people who are working on the buses, parents who have students in school, coaches, people who run after-school programs are all sort of, it's a broad base of people who are involved with this. And in many ways, it's a it's sort of a class struggle, because the 1%, you know, they don't send their kids to schools that are underfunded, you know, so they don't really have to worry about this. And so, you know, you really see when, you know, in these movements, you see a sort of, you know, a broad base of unity that extends beyond, you know, just the teachers themselves. And that's also represented in their demands. You know, they're not just concerned, you know, they're obviously rightfully concerned about their pay. You know, Oklahoma teachers haven't had a raise since 2008. But, you know, they're also demanding increased investments in education. They're also demanding increased compensation for bus drivers, for support staff. So you really see a, you know, it's not just sort of, you know, one sector of the education system.
It really goes to the notion that the entire system is broken, and it's broken in states all across this country. It's not just the teachers. It's not just the fact that they have to pay out of their own pocket for classroom supplies. But you're right. It's the bus drivers. It's the janitors. It's the school nurse. It's everybody who works for the state or works for the local school district. Everybody is being set back a little more every single year.
Yeah. And Derek, you know, 60, 70 years ago, teaching was considered like an exalted position in some ways. Maybe it was never paid properly. Same with university professors, and you're a university professor. But over time and over the decades, the status of this profession has been reduced. I mean, it really is now, it's so interesting, like the center of working class organizing. If people thought of themselves as professionals at one time, at a certain point when you don't get raises for, you know, years and sometimes decades, when you're treated like this, when you have to have a second and third job, you have to think of yourself as a worker, not just as a professional, even though you have professional training.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, we're seeing, you know, basically a proletarianization of, you know, so many sectors in the United States. And there's definitely been a systematic attack on teaching as a profession. You know, the idea that anyone can be a teacher, Teach for America, these sort of alternative certification programs are, you know, it's really all part of a systematic attack on public education in the United States. And it's so inspiring to see so many people fighting back against this attack.
Indeed it is. We're going to have to end there. We were joined from Greencastle, Indiana by Derek Ford. Derek is an assistant professor of education studies at DePauw University and a community organizer whose latest book is Education and the Production of Space. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. A report published over the weekend by sports news website Deadspin showed dozens of television news anchors from local stations around the country owned by the conservative Sinclair Broadcasting Group reciting the exact same script warning against what they called biased and false news. The episode reveals the power of a company long criticized for pushing its conservative agenda into homes across the country. We're joined from New York by Tim Carr. Tim is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Tim, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tim, Free Press has been working on the issue of Sinclair and its right-wing agenda for many years. Are you at all surprised by this little scandal?
No, Sinclair has a long history of using its very extensive network of local television stations to push its own political agenda. And it's only under the Trump administration that there's been a near-perfect pairing of news organization with a political leader who would like the media to mouth his agenda. Trump has recently been tweeting in favor of Sinclair only because it has a tendency to take a lot of his talking points, like the false news, the fake news talking points, and putting them out over its network of local stations.
You know, one of the things that really troubles me is a very recent poll that was done by the Pew Research Center that said that 85% of Americans trust their local news outlets. That's more than the 77% of Americans who trust their family or friends for news. And I think most Americans have no idea when their local television station is controlled or owned by Sinclair.
They don't, and Sinclair doesn't advertise that to local viewers, but they do require that it's their network of stations carry what's called must-run commentary. They have a person who was a former Trump staffer, Boris Epstein, who creates a 2 to 3 minute commentary that Sinclair then ships out to its large network of stations. They control about 190 stations across the country, and they require that they air that commentary. And that commentary has included, you know, tirades against undocumented immigrants, tirades against what Trump would call fake news. I mean, it's very much in line with the agenda of the president. And so that's why a lot of people have come to call Sinclair Trump TV. It's sort of an unofficial propaganda outlet for the president.
And in fact, the Washington Post says that the broadcast areas of Sinclair stations voted for Trump over Hillary Clinton by a 19 percentage point margin on average. Another thing, too, and this is something that I didn't know until this scandal broke in the last 2 days, was that Sinclair owned stations across all four of the major broadcast networks. So it's not like it's every local Fox station is owned by Sinclair. We're talking Fox, ABC, CBS, NBC, and some unaffiliated TV stations, as well as 9 Univision affiliates in Spanish.
And interestingly, Sinclair also has concentrated ownership in what are called political battleground states. Battleground states are those states like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania that often are a decisive factor in national elections. And Sinclair has concentrated ownership in those politically charged regions, not only because it benefits from political advertising, a lot of the political advertising, which amounts to billions of dollars in a general election year, is channeled into those local markets where they're trying to influence voters. So it benefits not only from the flow of political ad money, but also from it for its ability to sway important local elections that whose outcome could have national relevance.
This video that Deadspin published a couple of days ago has already been viewed over 8 million times, according to CNN. It was CNN that broke this story in March, but it was Deadspin that layered the video clips of all of these dozens and dozens of local anchors reading exactly the same script, complaining about fake news and all of these other horrible left-wing conspiracies. So I wonder, is there anything that anybody can do? I mean, what do you do in a case like this? Do you complain to the FCC? Do you write a letter to your congressman? Or are we stuck with right-wing ownership of much of our national media?
Well, there are things you can do. Unfortunately, right now we have an FCC under a Trump-appointed chairman, Ajit Pai,
right,
who is willing to kick out all the regulatory stops for Sinclair to get even larger. Sinclair is in the process of gobbling up Tribune Media, which owns 43 more television stations. That would give Sinclair about 230 stations with a broadcast reach to 70, more than 70% of the company, of the country, rather. And if the FCC is in place to ensure that there is local competition and diversity and choice in the media, they have fallen down on the job. They are deregulating broadcast ownership limits so that Sinclair can move forward. One of the things that Free Press has done to oppose that is we're taking the FCC to court. We are suing them for a series of decisions that they've made to change the way broadcast ownership is limited in the United States. So we've also asked people to write to the FCC to voice their opposition to Sinclair's planned merger with Tribune Media that has yet to be approved. Both the Department of Justice and the FCC have to sign off on that. So we're hoping that public pressure can prevent Sinclair from getting even larger.
Donald Trump tweeted something yesterday, as he is, actually it was this morning, as he is wont to do. He doubles down on these issues. He said, the fake news networks, those that knowingly have a sick and biased agenda, are worried about the competition and quality of Sinclair broadcasting. The fakers at CNN, NBC, ABC, and CBS have done so much dishonest reporting that they should only be allowed to get awards for fiction. So those are tough words, but not as tough as Mark Hyman's words. Mark Hyman is a former Sinclair executive who also leads a commentary segment that's one of the Sinclair must-run segments that you talked about at the beginning of this segment. And he said this, and this was broadcast on national television. He said, and I quote, "Listen up closely, snowflakes. Yes, I'm talking to you. You, the social justice warrior who whines for trigger warnings and safe spaces. College isn't a babysitting service." Well, that's not news. That's not even really commentary. But this is what's force-fed to people all across America. What can we do about this?
Well, yes, it is. And the problem is that a lot of people who do trust their local news outlets watch this without understanding the structure behind the ownership of local television stations. The idea for the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, was put in place to promote localism, diversity, and competition in use of the public airwaves. And the agency has fallen down on that job, and it's allowed for companies like Sinclair to own now nearly 200 local television stations across the country. And what Sinclair does is, rather than support local news content, rather than to promote diversity of voices over the airwaves, it creates a central news hub, and then it syndicates out that news coverage to all of its stations. So we're losing local newsrooms, we're losing local reporters, and in its place, we're getting this, in the case of the Trump era, this sort of propaganda that's very much in line with the Trump administration, which just so happens to be considering a number of regulations that would help Sinclair get even bigger. So there's this quid pro quo going on that is, should be very concerning for everyone. And there are a lot of things that people can do. They can challenge the licenses of their local station. Every 8 years, their station license, broadcast license, comes up for renewal, and there is a mechanism at the FCC to challenge those licenses. But we can also pressure our members of Congress to speak out. Congress has oversight of the FCC. You can speak out directly to the FCC and oppose this merger, something that Free Press is coordinating right now. Or you can support our work and our legal challenges against the FCC, which is trying to push through these deregulatory measures that would allow for Sinclair to control even more local media.
Very important words right there. This merger is a $3.9 billion merger with Tribune Media, which would add 42 more local TV stations to Sinclair's lineup. And there's a law in this country limiting single station owners from reaching 39% of the national television audience. This FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, has already ended net neutrality. Everybody's watching to see what he does with this Sinclair Tribune media deal. Unfortunately, though, we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director for Strategy and Communications at Free Press. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Russian President Vladimir Putin arrived in Ankara today to launch Turkey's first nuclear power plant with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, also to discuss Syria, energy, and defense issues. The Russian State Nuclear Energy Agency will build the $20 billion nuclear power facility, and the Russian State News Agency also noted that Russia will expedite the delivery of the S-400 air defense system to Turkey. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Welcome, Mark.
Brian, John, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thanks for joining us. Mark, this seems like a very substantive kind of meeting. It doesn't seem to be window dressing. When you're talking about a major air defense system, you're talking about a $20 billion nuclear power facility, and then you've invited the president of Iran at the same time. What's this all about?
I'm not quite sure, so sure. I see this rather as a kind of political theater between two countries that are still at odds on many things, but for both countries' national interests and geopolitical interests have decided that they are going to play each other off of their enemies in kind of a mutually embracing cooperation while they keep daggers poised at each other's backs.
Again, for the audience, Mark, we've talked about this many times, but there may be people listening to the show here on the Washington radio stations for the first time. Just walk us very quickly through how the relations between Russia and Turkey have gone through like an up and a down and an up and a down. And as you say, the animus isn't disappeared, even though there appears to be this mutual embrace at the moment.
Sure. Turkey, as some of our viewers may have forgotten, is actually a member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which still keeps Russia in its sights as its primary enemy as it advances to the east across Europe, getting ever closer now literally on Russia's borders. And since Russia and Turkey, however, have had fair economic relations, and political relations after the end of the Cold War up until the beginning of the Syria conflict, where Turkey from the very beginning has been part of an alliance, illegally arming, training, and salarying sectarian militants, often embedded and allied with al-Qaeda to overthrow the Syrian government, which Russia has a mutual defense pact with. And Russia could simply not allow Syria to so close to its own borders, you know, simply basically 24 hours by jeep drive away from southern Russia up through the Caucasus. Failed state and a terrorist breeding ground like has evolved in Libya, with the concentration of forces arrayed against the Syrian government being almost entirely Wahhabist jihadi and Islamists to come to power in Syria, and you know any combination of those forces. And as they ended up on opposite sides of this conflict, with Turkey from the very beginning being the main logistic and support route through which these jihadis were funded, not only by Turkey, but by the United States, the United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. But they all had to cut everything, had to, and continues to come through Turkey. There's no other place that they can be supplied from except for in the very south of Syria, where there has always been limited conflict. A Russian jet was shot down on the Syrian-Turkish border in 2015, and its pilot then murdered, a war crime, as he descended in a parachute. And the presumed suspect of this, as it was taped by video, was actually a Turkish nationalist, a member of the Grain Wolves, who were fighting alongside the so-called Syrian rebels in northern Syria. After that, a Russian ambassador was killed in Turkey itself, gunned down. Relations since then have picked up with the start of the Astana Agreement, as Turkey has had its own disagreements with the United States and the EU come to the fore. The Astana Agreement is a way for Russia, Turkey, and Iran to come to the forefront of the Syrian conflict and to try to manage each other's often completely opposite, at least when it comes to Russia and Turkey and Iran and Turkey, their own interests in Syria and the Syrian conflict. What Turkey brings to the table is they literally represent the enemy, the jihadis that are trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And by dealing with Turkey and only Turkey, which again is the only supply route through which they continue to be armed and supplied on a daily basis as convoys of trucks, fuel, ammunition, weapons, food, etc., go back and forth across the Turkish border into northern Syria, Idlib, northern Aleppo, etc., that by dealing with Turkey, Russia can cut Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United States and the UK out of the negotiation process. Turkey has its own reasons for doing this, being extremely angered during the attempted coup to overthrow Erdogan a few years ago by elements within the Turkish military, which Erdogan has blamed on the United States. I think it much more likely that the U.S. knew something about it and simply didn't tell him about it. I think that's the actual source of the grievance. For once, I don't think the U.S. actually had their hand in this attempted coup because it was far too clumsy and had not the slightest chance of success, unlike their usual efforts of meddling. Also, how close the United States has come to the Syrian Kurds, the YPG, which the Turkish government regards as being synonymous with the Kurdish rebel group in Turkey, the PKK.
Mark, let me ask you a quick question too, because I think you're right on all of this so far. Here you've got Turkey that has poor relations with its neighbors, Greece and Cyprus. It has terrible relations with Israel. It's actively fighting its own Kurds, Syria's Kurds, Iraq's Kurds. It has so much more to gain with a close relationship with the Russians than the Russians have in a close relationship with Turks, I think. So why would the Russians seek out this warmer relationship with Turkey? What do the Russians get out of this?
Okay, well, one thing, Russian-Turkish trade is not insignificant. Russia does want increased energy trade with Turkey. That includes both nuclear and oil and gas. Whether these TurkStream pipe, which Turkey needs badly, whether these TurkStream pipelines ever end up really extending across into Europe is another matter. But at the very least, pipelines are needed into Turkey. Russia needs to end the Syrian conflict, and Turkey is the one to deal with where they can deal just with Turkey as representing the jihadis and no one else. They can cut all the rest out of this process. And also, Russia sees this conflict between Turkey and the EU over migration with the Syrian and other refugees and with the United States over the Kurds in the Syrian conflict, which the Pentagon has backed from the beginning, while as the CIA backed some of the Islamist groups that were also allied with Turkey. They see a chance to draw a wedge between Turkey and NATO. I don't think they think that Turkey is going. I don't think anyone thinks that Turkey is going to walk out of NATO anytime soon. But simply the increased tensions and the inability to reach geostrategic agreements between Turkey and the rest of NATO on the Middle East region is incredibly advantageous to Russia, to preventing exactly the type of conflicts that have been involved in trying to overthrow the Syrian government. So there's a lot for Russia to gain here, but there's a lot at stake too.
I think people don't know, of course, Americans don't know much about history or geography or much about those kind of areas. But Russia, when it was the Russian Socialist Federation, the year before it became the Soviet Union, was the first country in the world to recognize the Kemalist Turkish Revolution. That was 1920 and 21. There was the Treaty of 1925 that cemented Turkish-Soviet relations. It was only after World War II when the United States incorporated both Greece and Turkey into NATO, a U.S.-led anti-Soviet military alliance, that everything changed. I mean, shattered in terms of Turkish-Russian or Turkish-Soviet relations. But it does demonstrate, Mark, that things can go through historical shifts and changes as a result of big new alignments and realignments. Are you anticipating anything like that? We have 1 minute left, so that, of course, that's a short answer for a big question.
Yeah, I mean, we also can't forget that the U.S. put nuclear missiles in Turkey, which precipitated Russia, the Soviet Union, to put missiles in Cuba, which precipitated the Cuban Missile Crisis. And a lot of people don't know that the U.S., in an agreement to end the crisis, pulled weapons out. So that's another Turkish-Russian historical instrument. I don't foresee any great immediate geopolitical shift. But certainly Erdogan's swing to Islam and his focus on presenting himself as some kind of ummah of the Islamic world, drawing closer to these jihadi groups and regimes, does mark a real shift. Turkey is no longer a military guaranteed secular republic. It is moving in the direction of the Islamic world. That's a long-term process, but NATO and the U.S. aren't quite ready to give up Turkey yet. It's too important for their geopolitical control of the region, airspace, and energy assets in the Middle East. So that will be a gradual shifting away rather than a dramatic immediate shift, I believe.
We will leave it right there. We were joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a break and be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Prosecutors in the Russia probe revealed last night that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein authorized them in August of last year to investigate allegations that President Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was colluding with Russian government officials to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. The revelation comes amid a lawsuit filed by Manafort, which challenges the special counsel's investigative authority and the indictments already issued. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who's also the author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Plot to Attack Iran. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My first question, I think, has to be, is this just the desperation of a man who's facing the rest of his life in prison? Or is there something to this legal challenge that the general counsel has overstepped his bounds? Or the special counsel, rather, has overstepped his bounds.
Go ahead, Jim.
It looks to me like Manafort is desperate. And if I read Rosenstein's memo correctly, he gave them – the problem here isn't Mueller. It's Rosenstein. Rosenstein gave him the authority to do this. It was this weird paragraph that he could investigate any crime committed and payments received during the tenure of Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. So for some reason, during that time, they could go into anything they wanted. I don't see what that had to do with Russia. That ended in 2014, in Yanukovych's tenure. So I don't see what that had to do with the Russian meddling in the 2016 election. But Rosenstein's kind of directed Mueller to investigate it.
The timing here, just for the audience, because everybody's eyes are now glazing over with the Russiagate stuff.
You, seriously.
I mean,
they really are.
Unless you happen to be on our show 1,800 times talking about it, which both Dan and Jim have done, thankfully. Yeah, it's hard to keep up. But just let's listen to what Jim Cavanaugh just said. The coup that overthrew Yanukovych was February 22nd, 2014. Yanukovych was not, quote, a pro-Russian puppet. He was a player. He was a corrupt guy who was playing both sides, both the EU side and the Russian side. The one thing was he wasn't willing to have Ukraine become part of NATO. You can't play both sides and be in NATO. So there was a coup, and the U.S. supported the coup, and the coup dislodged him from power, and he escaped, and a new government was created. That was February 2014. Before that, Manafort, Paul Manafort, who became Donald Trump's chairman for a brief amount of time during the 2016 campaign, was functioning as a lobbyist for Yanukovych in Washington, currying favor for the Yanukovych government, getting paid. Others did too, perhaps Tony Podesta. We'll see about that. But nonetheless, that was before the election campaign. And probably the Putin government saw that meddling by an American is something that would possibly damage Russian-Ukrainian relations, not the other way around. But nonetheless, what Manafort's accused of in this indictment, Dan Kovalik, is laundering the money that he got from illicit work in Ukraine before 2014, then not paying taxes on it and laundering it by buying real estate properties in America to clean that dirty money up. Again, nothing to do with the election campaign.
Yeah, well, I think that is what is most concerning, and that is that, you know, the essence of Mueller's charge is to go after you know, alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And as you say, the indictment against Manafort has nothing to do with that. But it does appear that he got the authority from the DOJ to engage in the investigation of the very items that Manafort was indicted for, though they're wholly independent from the whole Russiagate saga. So I don't know what we make of it. I mean, I think it's probably hard to argue that what Mueller is doing is improper, given his charge. But it does, to me, cast a whole question on the entire investigation, and that is whether it is, in fact, some type of witch hunt, you know, that they're going to find all these secondary, tertiary allegations against people associated with Trump that don't go to the Russia collusion, and then they're going to claim that somehow they've succeeded in their charge. And it's just, I think it's going to really confuse a lot of people and maybe fool a lot of people that there's more to the Russiagate allegations than there really are.
I think one of the ways we may be able to tell if there's anything is with Alex van der Zwaan. Alex van der Zwaan was an attorney connected to Paul Manafort. He was an attorney at Skadden Arps, which is one of the largest, most prestigious law firms in the world, has offices all around the world. He was also tied to Rick Gates. And he's a Dutch national who's the son-in-law of a Russian oligarch by the name of German Khan. Not a Russian name, but a Russian oligarch. He was sentenced today to 30 days in prison and fined $20,000 for lying to Mueller when Mueller asked him what exactly his connections were to Manafort and to Gates. He told a lie. He got indicted. He's the first one to be sentenced. He was the last one to be indicted, but the first one to be sentenced. That tells me that he's willing to talk. And he likely isn't going to just talk about Rick Gates, because we already know that Rick Gates has been offered a deal to talk about Paul Manafort. So I think we're going to see in short order if there really is anything to this collusion or if there's not. Now, we've said on this show, and I stand by this, we've said a million times, there likely is nothing to the collusion. But we said this in the very beginning, before the special counsel even got started. And in fact, we did it with Jim and with Dan, where we all agreed that we were going to see largely throwaway felonies, making a false statement, perjury, conspiracy, etc. And if there were serious charges, they wouldn't have anything to do with collusion. And I think that that's exactly what we have playing out here.
Well, Jim, let's talk about what this now sentenced lawyer, 30 days, that's a pretty...
30 days.
You can sneeze in Washington and get 31 days.
It's great, too. 30 days, and he has 60 days of probation.
Very weird. But what's that about, Jim? What do you think's happening there?
I have no idea. My best guess, I think John is suggesting this, is that that's because he made a deal. And my best guess is that's because he made a deal to testify against Manafort. And they're demonstrating to Manafort that, because he knows about Manafort, and they're demonstrating to Manafort that they got the goods on him. And that's why Manafort wants to try and quash the investigation. I don't think he's going to do it. But, you know, the whole thing, I'll say this again, you know, this is business. This is the business model for Washington, for everybody in Washington, is selling, you know, lobbying foreign governments, influence peddling. I don't see how they can go after Manafort and these people without going after the Podesta group, who was working with I'm sure they can find financial shenanigans that are illegal in some level with almost any lobbying firm in Washington that does international business. They might find it against the Trump Organization. It has nothing to do with election meddling, but it's a rat's nest and it's a can of worms. So they're going to open that up. The Clinton Foundation is the biggest influence. You know, nobody's been better at influence peddling and selling off influence than the Clinton Foundation.
Well, that's an important point. And we should also not forget that Paul Manafort didn't just arrive in Washington the other day. Paul Manafort was one of the three principals in Black, Manafort, and Stone. That's Charlie Black, Paul Manafort, and Roger Stone. This was the single most important Republican and conservative lobbying group in America, based in Alexandria, Virginia. Charlie Black has retired, but it was Paul Manafort who was one of the campaign managers for George H.W. Bush in 1988. It was Manafort who worked with Lee Atwater, if you remember that name, to vilify Michael Dukakis. So Manafort's been around for many years. He knew exactly what he was getting into, and he knew that he was high enough profile that people were going to want to knock him down.
Dan Kovalik, we only have about 2 minutes left. I have a feeling, no matter what happens with Manafort, and I agree with both of you, I don't think this is a Hail Mary. This is not going to succeed. The argument that Mueller has gone beyond the investigation when he found criminal wrongdoing so he can't prosecute Manafort, that's going to fail. But I believe we're past the point of no return with the Russiagate. Because when I read the newspapers, when I watch TV, the animus, the hostility, the foundational assumptions that Russia has declared an undeclared war against America and America must now fight back. That's where this is going. We are entering a new stage, and I think we've already entered it. I think it's not going away.
Yeah, well, I totally agree with you on that. I think we're in a very dangerous situation. A number of people have written about this recently, including Stephen F. Cohen, that, you know, the danger of nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia is...
I'll just interject and say I just published something on Counterpunch and on my blog about Russia mania at the boiling point and the danger of war. It's very serious.
Very serious. And what's happening with the U.K. with the unsubstantiated claims of, you know, the Russian chemical attack and the response there, we are certainly careening towards some type of conflict with Russia. And what's very upsetting is that many in the media just seem absolutely gleeful about the fact. You know, I listened to Scott Simon on Saturday, and he was just gleeful that, you know, Trump had decided to kick out 60 diplomats, Russian diplomats from the U.S. And to me, it's just incomprehensible how people could be welcoming this type of hostility between two great nuclear powers. It's just, it's beyond words, frankly.
Yeah, and official or unofficial liberalism in America who hate Trump, and he should be hated, but they love Trump whenever he does something really, really warlike against the other major thermonuclear power in the world.
Yeah.
I mean,
it defies all logic.
It defies all logic.
We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net, and he recently published The Warm War, Russia Mania at the Boiling Point at Counterpunch. And we were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Plot to Attack Iran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In this segment, we take a look at the trade war, the embryonic developing trade war between the United States and China. Donald Trump imposed more than $60 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods coming into the United States. The Chinese have retaliated with $3 billion in tariffs on more than 150 different products. Yesterday, we had a discussion with Jude Woodward. She was talking to us from London. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. We talked to Jude about what these tariffs mean, what Trump is trying to achieve, and trying to gauge or estimate, assess what the Chinese response actually looks like. Let's listen to our interview with Jude Woodward. If we look at what happened with Trump's negotiations with South Korea, I mean, South Korea and the United States negotiated the trade pact that took a decade to negotiate. Mm-hmm. And South Korea, now wary of a trade war by the Trump administration, is making new concessions. So perhaps Wall Street, perhaps the biggest banks, the biggest corporations, and now the Democrats who want to be viable think, oh, guess what? Maybe Donald Trump's aggressiveness is actually going to work. Anyway, Jude, what do you think?
Well, it may do in some cases. I don't really think it will in relation to China, to be perfectly honest, because I think China has a considerably more clout and is less dependent on the US than South Korea is, for example. I think that business opinion is on the whole in the United States against these tariffs. I think there is some section of business that those immediately affected by the tariffs or thinking they will be aided by the tariffs who are in favour. But I'm still surprised by Elizabeth Warren. I'm puzzled because I think internationally and in the US, the weight of opinion in business circles and is against these tariffs. And they will not, they will rebound on the United States. That was the lesson of Obama's tariffs on tires in 2007. The analysis of that tariff was that, yes, it cut Chinese imports of tires to the US by about 67%. And Obama was able to claim that 1,000, or it was true, that 1,200 jobs were created in the tire industry, created or saved in the tire industry in the US. But the total cost of the US economy of that was estimated to be £1.1 billion, i.e. each of those jobs cost $900,000. It would have been cheaper to just pay a few years' wages to people in the tire industry and you would have saved a lot of money. And that money had to come out of other sections of the economy, which it was estimated in the end cost 3,700 jobs in other sectors, particularly retail, and therefore the total impact was a loss of jobs of about 2,500 jobs in the US economy. So these tariffs tend to rebound on those, the country imposing them.
Judah's right. I want to give one anecdotal example, and this is why I think she's right. This is the root of it for me. Seamless steel is a part of this Chinese tariff package. People may not even give 2 seconds of thought to seamless steel, but seamless steel is much more hardy than seamed steel, which has rivets in it, right? So it takes many, many years longer to wear out. Seamless steel is manufactured only by J&L Steel of Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, a small town next to my hometown.
I wondered how you knew so much about seamless steel.
It's a heavily Democratic but very conservative town that went heavily for Donald Trump in the last election. This is going to backfire on Donald Trump, and it's going to hit him where it hurts, because the last thing that the seamless steel industry needs, the last thing that those union workers at J&L Steel need is a tariff imposed by the Chinese, so that now J&L simply can't sell its seamless steel in China, and the Chinese are going to buy it from the South Koreans and the Japanese, who also manufacture.
Yeah, and of course, the Chinese know exactly what they're doing in terms of what tariffs to impose. I mean, these are very pinpointed. And I'm looking again at the Wall Street Journal editorial from March 1st, 2018, which sort of substantiates Jude's main point. And the headline says it all: Trump's tariff folly. His tax on aluminum and steel will hurt the economy and his voters. That's the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I entirely agree with that. I mean, in the Rust Belt, they may believe for a while that this is doing some good. And as we saw, as I said, with Obama's tire tariffs, it did protect and create some jobs in the tire industry. So I don't know what the impact on the US steel industry would be. I'm not an expert on that. But certainly if it did aid some jobs in the US steel industry, that's a bit Donald Trump's electoral base. But the problem is it is going to cost jobs elsewhere in the economy, because that is going to cost, because US consumers are going to be paying more for things made of steel, because steel is going to become more expensive. So in other words, money is going to be absorbed by the economy in other ways, and other costs will accrue, which will have an impact on jobs elsewhere in the economy and indeed on inflation and on the cost of living.
That's the voice of Jude Woodward. We're speaking to her from the UK about Donald Trump's tariffs on China, and now China's announced retaliation. We're recording this show at 1 p.m. East Coast time on Monday in Washington, D.C., we're going to play part of this show later today and another part later tomorrow. But at the time of this recording, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 2.2%. NASDAQ is down 2.5%. Crude oil is down 2.5%. Substantial drops. The euro is down. The only thing going up right now is gold, and gold is the security haven when everything is up in the air, and obviously money, which is finding a place to nest, is uncertain right now because of the dislocations that a U.S.-China trade war would have on the world economy. And of course, Donald Trump is playing to his base. He's playing politics right now. This is 2018 midterm elections. Anyway, John, I think I'm glad you raised the part about Western Pennsylvania and seamless steel. And, you know, the headlines in the way the American people learn about economics is, well, let's put it this way. They don't learn about economics. They in big picture, that's supposed to be something for economists, even though there's nothing more important for all of us than what's happening with the economy. It's whether we have a job, whether we have decent wages, whether we can have enough money to go to the doctor or to buy food or to pay a mortgage or pay rent. I mean, these are the vitals. And yet people don't really know. But Donald Trump is trying to play to this nativist orientation, America the humble giant, but now under Donald Trump's great leadership, we're coming back. This could have a profound, in fact, catastrophic impact on the U.S. economy.
Yeah, I agree. It could be a catastrophe because this isn't the end of the road for tariffs. You know, Donald Trump is still threatening the Mexicans, the Canadians, the South Koreans, the Japanese, and others. And certainly with the Chinese retaliation, Donald Trump is of the mindset or of the temperament to double down and impose even more restrictions. I would expect to see that.
Jude Woodward, let's combine economics with overall policy. Donald Trump is pursuing a particular economic policy with these tariffs, not shared by all of those in the economic and political establishment. But they come at the very same time after the national security strategy was released and the nuclear posture review, where the U.S. is now gearing up for major power confrontation in the coming decade, including with China and with Russia. When you think of it, big picture, we have 1 minute left. Where is this all heading?
Well, it's impossible to say, but it's dangerous. There's no doubt the changes in the administration, the shift in policies you've just outlined, all indicate you have a U.S. president and administration that is gearing up for major conflict. Whether that happens or not, we have yet to see, and there are many things that stand in the way, but it's a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I've sort of prided myself on not being hyperbolic or exaggerating, but I actually think that we've entered another new stage in global politics. The trade war is one part of it. The reorientation of the U.S. military and its strategic doctrines also dovetails with it. We've been joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingstone's advisor on culture and creative industries. She is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. We'll be right back.